pleasure to be here and to speak before this assembly, and you all have such expertise in this area that I am intimidated, but I will do my best, and although I say some things that may have been said before and may be said in the future, I hope to give a new spin on some of them, bringing some new examples. And I'll be speaking in English, but I left my examples in the originals, and if you would like a translation of that, I have that. I didn't do all the three-way translations, but in English at least. On this subject then, in this presentation, I examine some aspects of the intellectual debate on the uses of different languages as it originated in Western Europe and spread to Russia. An agent of imperial power such as Catherine the Great could champion Russian and promote its use in literature while simultaneously promoting and using French and German. My analysis of the cultural and societal rationales behind Russian foreign language use will, I hope, contribute to the discussion of how language was the site of both group identity formation and the imperial contestation of power in late 18th century Russia. The period saw the beginnings of the nationalist idea that Russians should only speak Russian, which gained force in the 19th century, as we've heard. But this proto-nationalism, however, competed with an understanding of French as a valid means for Russians to enter the broader social sphere of Europe and the Enlightenment, and to distance themselves from the Russian common people. I'll begin by listing the factors that, in my view, contributed to language choice among Russians during this period, and how they are influenced by similar debates taking place in Western Europe. I will then delve into Catherine's correspondence with Voltaire and Grimm to show how she herself became involved in language debate, and how this came to affect her own cultural activities and policies. Many different models have been proposed for the role of French in Russian society. And in the vein of scholars such as Michelle Morese, who is not here, but she's done work on the subject, I prefer to move away from the simple binary that sets Russian in opposition to Western European languages. Whereas the binary model was not completely absent among thinkers of the second half of the 18th century, I feel like the strong expression of that binary narrative, it seems overly teleological because it looks forward to the point in the 19th century when it became more, the Slavophile Westernizer debate, when that binary opposition became more enforced. Even the limited sources used in this essay show that the different languages in Russia, the Russian Empire, occupy different positions in a complex linguistic system, one that cannot be reduced to a simple binary model. Some of these complications should be anticipated from the outset. Any study of imperial Russian cultural processes must necessarily enter into debate on the various forms that the Russian Empire was constructed. Russia was both a country that colonized itself, in the words of Vasily Kuchevsky, and a colonial power in the traditional sense of establishing dominance over the people, over other peoples, through settlement and economic exploitation. Russia's imperial particularity should therefore give pause to any historian or other scholar who would present a simplistic picture of language hierarchy. In constructing this complex system of language use, Russians could draw on a variety on a variety of different principles to establish a system of languages, ranging from the purely pragmatic, as we've heard, speaking or writing Russian when it was easiest to write Russian and French when it was easiest to write French. But they also had more ideological or abstract notions of the merits of different languages. In the end, the pragmatic aspect probably remained the most important in actual use. Language choice was driven by the need to communicate within a larger community. The chosen community, however, depended on the viewpoint and aspirations of the individual. For many in the Russian elite, the primary imagined community was that of European enlightened society. And cultural affinity with the Russian lower classes was often secondary or limited to certain contexts. Russia was not unique in its complex interrelation of Enlightenment ideals and rational identity. In France itself, the attempts of the political elite to form a national culture were thwarted by regionalism on the one hand, and the cosmopolitanism of figures such as Voltaire on the other. However, owing to Russia's position on the geographic periphery of the dominant Western culture, I find that the Russian adoption and transformation of cultural ideas is at times more visible than it is in Central and Western Europe. In this claim, I'm following the Italian historian Franco Venturi, who emphasized the peripheral areas of the Western world, such as Italy, Greece, and Russia, as sites in which the tensions and transformations of the Enlightenment can best be observed. The complex nature of the Russian situation is visible when we attempt to construct a coherent hierarchical model for the uses of different languages. It would seem reasonable, for instance, to put French at the top of this hierarchy. Yet, French did not extend into all domains of prestige. So this gets into the discussion of that glossia that we've heard before. Consider, for instance, the use of Church Slavonic in the liturgy, and French did not replace Church Slavonic in that area. Or the use of Russian in the bureaucracy, as we've heard, specifically the Prikazny Yazyk variety of Russian. The use of German, as we heard in the previous session, also presents an interesting picture. As a Western European language, it entered Russia as a prestige language, particularly in the realm of science. It's the dominant language of the Russian Academy during this period, which included such notables as the Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler. Yet German was also one of the vernacular languages of the Russian Empire, being spoken not only by German immigrants in Moscow and other places of central Russia, but also by native-born German speakers in the Baltic states. Imperially speaking, therefore, German was in some sense subordinate to the needs of the Russian-speaking metropole, and I think this gets to the quote that someone brought up in the last section, German is a language of butchers, and but I think that's part of it, but then on the other hand, German is also this educated language, so it's a sort of dual signification there. At the same time that certain European languages were seen as occupying different positions in the system of linguistic power, Russians also proposed more abstract reasons for choosing different languages. They were influenced by and participated in a larger debate within the European Republic of Letters on the merits of different languages. One scholar who studied this is Matthew Lauzon, and I'm relying somewhat on this. He looked at only Western Europe and applying it to the Russian context. In his work, we learn that British and French thinkers came to perceive the need for a single speech community, starting in the 17th century. And some explored the possibility of creating an artificial language, sort of foreshadowing Esperanto. Others hoped to find an ideal speech community among the animals or among the native tribes of the New World. But most, however, attempted to use a language that already existed. And this led to an intense debate over the inherent merits of various existing languages. A significant source for both the European and the Russian context for the debate is Diderot and D'Alembert's Encyclopédie, published between 1751 and 1772. The Encyclopédie, another Enlightenment text, as many of you know, were widely read in Russia, and they even received state approbation from Catherine II. And who also corresponded personally with Diderot and Voltaire. In the Encyclopédie, the preliminary discourse, which is the introduction, is written by D'Alembert, describes the decline of Latin as a universal language and the emergence of French. While the author views French as capable of fulfilling this role of the universal language, he says that the use of French, which is a national language as well, would inspire other nations to follow suit, and thus resulting in a second Babel, Tower of Babel. He says, les savants des autres nations à qui nous avons donné l'exemple ont cru avec raison qu'ils écrivaient encore mieux dans leur langue que dans la nôtre. L'Angleterre nous a donc imité. L'Allemagne, où le latin semblait s'être réfugié, commence insensiblement à en perdre l'usage. Je ne doute pas qu'elle ne soit bientôt suivie par les Suédois, les Danois et les Russiens. The stance of the Encyclopédie on the nature of language was further developed in the article Langue, written by Nicolas Bauzet, published in 1765. Bauzet repeated the notion that French was overtaking Latin as a universal language. He attributed this change to both to the inherent virtues of the French language, as well as to the political importance of France. He said, il ne faut pas douter que ce goût universel ne soit dû autant aux richesses de notre littérature qu'à l'influence de notre gouvernement sur la politique générale de l'Europe. So he saw both the sort of pragmatic and the just French was the most useful language inherently. This argument spread to Russia. It was actually earlier, so I'm not sure of the causality of this. It was advanced by the Russian Mikhail Lomonosov in an essay entitled «О нынешнем состоянии словесных наук в России». He asserted the usefulness of literature in forming civilization. And he pointed to the example of France, writing «Просто только справедливостью сомневаться можно, могуществом ли больше привлеклась своему почитанию другие государства или науками, особливо словесными, очистив и украсив свой язык трудолюбием искусных писателей». For him, the two reasons were also important. He also added his voice to the debate on the merits of different languages in his Russian Grammar, 1755. Lomonosov began his introduction to this work by relating a popular anecdote about the uses of different languages. Карл V, римский император, говорил, что испанским языком с Богом, французским с друзьями, немецким с неприятелями, итальянским с женским полом говорить прилично. But then drawing on the negative argument implicit in this anecdote that French isn't appropriate for religion, German for friendship, etc., he praised Russian for its multifunctionality. He said, «Но если бы он российскому языку был искусен, то, конечно, к тому присовокупил бы, что им со всеми онными говорить пристойно, ибо нашел бы в нем великолепие испанского, живость французского, крепость немецкого, нежность итальянского, сверх того богатство и сильную в изображениях краткость греческого и латинского языка». So it includes the merit, the virtues of all these different languages. The Western European debate on the merits of different languages came through at several points in Catherine's correspondence with Voltaire, which will be brought up in the other papers as well. In their letters, discussions of language generally arose in three contexts. Discussion of Catherine's nakas, or instruction, and its reception in Europe. Commentary on the progress of Catherine's war with Turkey, and Voltaire's attempts to have various young noblemen introduced into Russian society. In this paper, I'm only going to discuss the nakas. She composed this instruction as a guide for the All of Russian Legislative Assembly of 1767, which had the mission of creating a new code of laws for Russia to replace the Soborne Ulazhenie, which had been in effect since 1649. So it was high time to create a new code of laws. The endeavor eventually failed, however, leading some historians to dismiss the nakas as an example of Catherine's hypocrisy, not as wanting to appear enlightened, but without taking the social risk. Nevertheless, at the time the piece was widely praised in Europe, it was feared by conservative authorities, such as the French monarchy, which banned it. Voltaire was one of the main promoters of the nakas within Europe, and his correspondence with the Russian Empress contains numerous references to it. Catherine sent Voltaire the least bad French translation of her nakas in 1767, noting that it already appeared in much poorer translations across Europe. This is where language comes into it. She said, writing in French, of course, Il a été si fort estropié dans les gazettes de Hollande qu'on ne savait pas trop ce qu'il pouvait signifier. She attributed the problems of translation to the specific virtues of the Russian language. En russe, c'est une pièce estimée. La richesse et les expressions fortes de notre langue l'ont rendu telle. La traduction en a été d'autant plus pénible. This statement is remarkable, especially given the fact that many of the sentences that she used were plagiarized from French and Italian sources. Nevertheless, Voltaire responded without defending French in this instance. He said, Je ne sais point la langue russe, mais par la traduction que vous daignez m'envoyer, je vois qu'elle a des imperfections et des tours qui manquent à la nôtre. Je ne suis pas comme une dame, someone mentioned this previously. Je ne suis pas comme une dame de Versailles qui disait, c'est bien dommage que l'aventure de la tour de Babel ait produit la confusion des langues. Sans cela, tout le monde aurait toujours parlé français. L'empereur de la Chine, Kang Qi, votre voisin, demandait à une missionnaire si on pouvait faire des vers dans les langues de l'Europe. Il ne pouvait le croire. So in this quotation, we see that Voltaire did not defend French against the accusation that it has a poor vocabulary. He was even willing to accept that a language that he did not know, Russian, could be more suitable for enlightenment. Moreover, this acknowledgement corresponds to his assumed role as a promoter of cosmopolitanism. At the same time, however, by making a comparison between Russian and Chinese, he implicitly keeps Russian in the same category as exotic non-European languages, and Russia's relation to the West as that of a curious but an alien observer. He also seemed to be implicitly warning Catherine against taking too strong a stance in favor of Russia by making it seem very exotic. Even after Catherine gave up on her grand legislative project, Voltaire continued to express his admiration of her smaller legal achievements. And I'm going to skip through this, actually, but he again praises Russian, and he says that it's Russian. Cette dernière langue est si riche, si énergique, et souffre tant d'inversion et composition de termes that it's very hard to translate. But then after saying that, he said, it should still be translated because it's such a great work, and into French, into Chinese, and he goes on. But I'd like to, in my remaining minutes, get to the other point of this paper, which gets to more the reception of Western European languages on a somewhat lower level. Some of the same themes that arose in the Voltaire correspondence appear in the documents connected with the debate surrounding the status of the German language, which originated in Prussia and later spread to Russia. This debate was characterized by the same tensions between national justifications for language use and a desire to participate in European society in the more widely spoken French. The German debate, however, contains an additional intricacy in that the use of German was contested not only within the Russian Empire, but also in the German-speaking states. In November 1780, King Frederick the Great, Frederick II of Prussia, published a treatise on German literature called De la littérature allemande, which set off a flurry of debate. In it, Frederick cast a critical eye on the German language and literary tradition, setting it in unfavorable opposition to French, Latin, and Greek. He dismissed German as half-barbarous, divided into unintelligible dialects, and without an established artistic style or national purity. And he only could think of a few German readers, German writers that could equal the French standard. Overall, though the Prussian monarch saw the possibility for the improvement of German as a language, he expressed a preference for the continued use of French, largely because of its universality in a European educated society. He called it a passe-partout, which is like a master key. Although it had some defenders, Frederick's essay was criticized by most commentators, both within and outside Germany. The main subject of complaint was Frederick's neglect of the existing German literary figures such as Lessing and Herder, who had already written great works. While the widespread criticism of Frederick's essay prevents us from taking his representative of German society as a whole, it's interesting because of its effect on the debate within the Russian Empire. Frederick's essay generated a good deal of commentary in Russia, both among German-speaking subjects of the Russian Empire and among native Russians. Catherine, as well, criticized the work in her correspondence, and in the extant commentaries published in Russia on Frederick's essay, writers praised Catherine for her support of the German language and literature alongside Russian and French. Catherine personally reacted to Frederick's treatise in a letter to Melchior Grimm, a German-born French author who spent several years in Russia in the 1770s, and who at times corresponded with the Empress almost daily. Grimm was the first to inform her of the debate, saying that, now you certainly cannot deny that this illustrious author is no match for his material and judges the German language nearly as a blind man would flowers. And it's interesting that in this letter that he writes to Catherine, he puts that sentence in German, but then he continues in French. Catherine responded to Grimm's letter by attributing Frederick's ignorance to his old age. Que voulez-vous? Il a pris son pli. Il voit peu de monde, et quand il en voit, c'est lui qui parle et les autres écoutent. Personne n'a intérêt de le contredire, et on le craint. But then she says she as well is getting old. And l'âge encore y entre pour quelque chose. L'année 1740, nous étions jeunes et nous ne le sommes plus. But she doesn't consider herself to be as out of touch as her German peer. In the letter to Grimm, she writes of several German authors that she admires. Getting to the end. Catherine's self-stylization as both a Russian and a French monarch was both formative and reflective of the elite Russian mentalité of this period. Although national concerns, such as creation of a standardized literary Russian, became more important toward the end of the century, they were not generally regarded as precluding simultaneous use of Western European linguistic and cultural forms. Elite educated users of Western European languages could thus feel as though they fit into Russian imperial society. In fact, advocates of German literature in Russia allotted more praise to Catherine because of the seeming benevolence than to Frederick, who was actually a monarch of a German-speaking nation. This universalizing pan-European mentality that I've identified here continued to exist into the 19th century. An understanding of this mentality is therefore essential to our understanding of the later period of foreign language use, when ideas of national character became more essential in discussions of language choice. Russians were not exceptional during this period in having a less starkly defined national identity, as we've seen tensions between national and universal culture often surfaced in France and Germany as well. Yet Russia's position on the periphery of the European cultural sphere and its immense and multilingual land empire gave its engagement in Western European debates on language use. It gave those debates extra prominence. Continued studies of language debates in Russia from this period will therefore serve to enlighten our understanding of parallel debates in other countries of both Western and Eastern Europe. Thank you.